are a team in Racine, which are a consulting firm committed to community engagement, education, training, and development. They empower individuals, organizations, and communities through engagement and education on strategies that make a lasting impact. Thank you very much for joining me. Have a wonderful October 7th. This is Jess on 91.1 WGTD HD.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard each Saturday morning at 10:30 on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Archive programs are available on our website, WGTD.org, and you're invited to continue the discussion on the Education Matters Facebook page. Support for WGTD comes from Kenosha Harbor Market, featuring the grilled meats of Superb Grill, jerk chicken, rib tips, beef brisket, and more. The market is open Saturdays from 9 until 2 on and along 2nd Avenue and Plaza de Way. Support comes from Frederick South. United Hospital System is now part of the Frederick and the Medical College of Wisconsin Health Network, offering a seamless link to the specialty and complex care resources of Eastern Wisconsin's only academic medical center. Visit FrederickSouth.com. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Community Matters, a program that highlights various local issues and organizations. It's co-hosted by Len Iaquinta, a nonprofit manager, fundraiser, and consultant, WGTD Walworth County correspondent Jim McClure, and by Linda Fleshinsky, a mother, grandmother, freelance writer, and former Racine School Board president. And now, here's today's host.
Good morning. This is Len Iaquinta for Community Matters, and my guest today is Michael Gravely, the District Attorney for Kenosha County. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
We have a lot to talk about today. You have a busy office and a lot of work to do to help keep Kenosians safe and keep the law enforced. The first thing I'd like to observe is that you've been honored recently. You were recently elected. You haven't been in office all that long. How long has it been?
I got elected in last November, so I've been in office since January of this year.
And you were named Prosecutor of the Year just before that.
I was. I got that award from the Attorney General's office.
Congratulations. There's a wonderful picture I researched here of you being hugged by Jim Cruiser. And then I also noticed that you've been honored by another organization that I respect very much, Congregations United to Serve Humanity here in Kenosha. What was that about?
Well, that was really a tremendous honor. That's a group of individuals connected to churches here in the community who do a lot of work on trying to figure out how to improve the criminal justice system and provide rehabilitative opportunities for individuals who've been to prison and to jail. And they chose to honor me with an award because of, I think, a lot of the things that we've been discussing together over the last 6 months.
Well, that's great. The rehabilitation is a very important watchword and is supposed to be an integral part of our justice system, although sometimes I wonder if it is as integral as it's supposed to be. District Attorney Gravely, the drug epidemic has been in the news a lot. I might tell our listeners that we are recording this program 2.5 weeks before broadcast, so if some news breaks that we don't comment on, that's why. But in the Kenosha News, the morning we recorded this, there was the note that the governor had signed 11 opioid bills into law. Mike, what is this all about, and why are these new laws important to the state of Wisconsin and to our people?
Well, I think really this opioid crisis, meaning both prescription pain pills and then heroin and methadone and now fentanyl, which is a very deadly drug that's come into the community very recently, that this is really the primary crisis within the criminal justice system and I think literally within the community right now. And this is true across the state. We have a tremendous problem right now, and I think the politicians from both parties are trying everything they can to try to solve this.
I just wanted to ask, you know, there have always been news stories and swings in public opinion about, you know, what's important, what's really a crisis, what isn't. This one is for real, though, isn't it?
Yeah, I can tell you that, you know, I've been a prosecutor since 1989. I've never seen a drug crisis with the deadly dimension of this and the sort of profound effect it's having on the criminal justice system. We are here in Kenosha County, experiencing more than 50 overdose deaths every year based on opioids. That's been true for the last 4 years. That's a tripling of the overdose deaths we would have had a decade ago. These are from folks in rural communities. They're from folks in the city. Who is addicted to heroin and pain pills in this community is completely different than the individuals that most of us had stereotypes were the prior heroin addicts in prior generations. So the dimensions of this problem are just really huge. I want to simply say this when folks think about this problem. Heroin in this community has never been cheaper than it is right now, and it's never been more pure, which means it's never been more deadly and dangerous. Heroin in this community is now cheaper than cocaine, and the economics of heroin is that it is addicting in a deadly way, very cheap, and really toxic.
I was surprised to read in an obituary in the Kenosha News recently where it was actually said in the obituary that he died after this overdose of opioids. And I can't ever remember seeing anything like that in an obituary before, a public obituary. And I can only suppose that the family wants to warn other people.
Yeah, one of the difficulties we have with this crisis is the stigma that I think a lot of families feel and a lot of friends and associates feel. And, you know, I've gone around this community now to all sorts of places talking about the epidemic we're in. And I'll talk about the deaths that I have seen, you know, in the criminal justice system. And then as I leave, there'll be one or two people who come up and privately share with me a personal story about somebody that they loved and cared about who is deceased. And I've thought to myself many times, boy, if those people would all come forward in those public conversations, maybe more families would be able to seek the kind of help that is needed to sort of defeat these kind of diseases, these kind of outbreaks.
Well, Mike, the governor signed 2.5 weeks before this broadcast airs 11 bills about opioids. Can you summarize for us what's changed now?
Well, these bills primarily do afford some additional treatment opportunities. Then they also increase the immunity that individuals who are overdosing would get. In other words, if somebody is on probation and parole, and somebody then calls 911 and they've overdosed and they're revived, that person would not be able to be revoked on probation or parole as long as they sought treatment. That's the user. So the concept being that this might be another vehicle to help an individual seek treatment, and that family members who were worried the person would return to prison or jail might pause and hesitate before they called 911. And, you know, now we have a drug, Narcan, that we've never had in our prior heroin crises over the generations that literally is saving lives. So when we talk about 50 overdose deaths now, Lynn, we're really talking about, we're not even talking about the 100 or 150 lives saved in this county every year. In any prior heroin sort of era, we would have 150 or 200 people dying in this community every year.
So this is really significant in your view.
Yeah, it is. I really feel it is the primary thing that we're suffering from right now. And it's going to get worse before it gets better.
Now, how does the new legislation affect the Good Samaritan or a fellow user who sees another user get in trouble beside her or him and wants to call 911? How does this affect those people?
So a bill last year already gave immunity to the friend or family member who might have been a co-user who called 911. So that person already has immunity. Right now, in our community or in any place across the state, if you've used heroin or possess heroin when a 911 call is made by yourself to try to help a person who's overdosing, you will have immunity. You cannot be charged criminally in the state of Wisconsin.
Are there any other features, District Attorney Gravely, in this series of 11 bills that are important to let our listeners know about?
No, I think we've done an adequate job of summarizing them.
Now, one of the things that your office is noted for is its diversion programs. Oh, but before I get to that, I was going to ask you: does the state provide any money for this new legislation? Does it? Is this going to cause extra costs if it provides for more treatment? Who pays for it?
So it did budget some additional money for treatment, and that was one of the key pieces of this new legislation this time, that there was some additional money that was budgeted for treatment programs that they had talked about in prior legislation. And, you know, one of the things that we're finding in our diversion programs and in our treatment efforts in Kenosha County is that a lot of individuals are covered either by private insurance or by Medicaid for treatment for opioids. So we're at a situation now, as long as Medicaid is not cut, where we really have an availability from Medicaid. One of the excellent parts about Medicaid is it affords the ability to get people the treatment they need.
So you're not concerned about the monetary effects of this?
Well, I think that's always a factor, and it should always be something seriously considered by taxpayers and by public officials. But I think the cost in terms of new crimes that occur and deaths in these communities are much higher than the cost of providing treatment.
Good. Now, getting back to the diversion programs, first of all, this is a term that we hear and newscasters use all the time and rarely really explains. Why don't we explain what a diversion program is? Normally we think of the district attorney as someone who investigates, charges people, puts them in jail, or gets them cleared and seeks justice above all. What's a diversion?
So what a diversion program is it's another tool in the toolbox within the criminal justice system to be sure that you try to tailor the consequences and what you do with a case to the particular defendant and the particular crime. And so a diversion program in general would be using a less formal solution. Sometimes a person would still plead guilty to the charge. Sometimes it would be before somebody pled guilty. But you use a less formal process of monitoring and really make people pay restitution and seek treatment in a quicker way, which uses less resources within the criminal justice system.
So the benefit is less cost for the criminal justice system. What are the other benefits?
The other benefit is that if you have an individual who is a first offender or new to the criminal justice system, you're not lumping them in with everyone else. You have a less formal alternative that doesn't put them in a jail or a formal probation setting where the people they're around and experiencing that situation with may be much more chronic than they are. And instead, you're tailoring the services and the outcome to those individuals who who are through the system for their first time.
Ah, it sounds to me like it's sort of like the magic word there is you're looking for good outcomes and you're looking for justice.
Well, absolutely.
And fairness. Absolutely.
I mean, the priority has to be that we use our extremely limited resources and we tailor them based on, what the problems are you bring to the table. So, for instance, in the major diversion program that we've authored this year, we're taking individuals who are opioid dependent, who have not been in the criminal justice system before, and before they're charged with a crime, we're offering them the opportunity to do treatment. And they first have to stay in a facility until they detox, which is a difficult process for an opioid addict. And then they have to begin to take what are called a drug called Vivitrol, which is a injectable once-a-month drug that takes away the craving for opioids. And then they are monitored and they have counseling because, you can't just give somebody a shot and not deal with the problems that have brought the addiction on. So, it's a comprehensive thing where we have staff in the DA's office who are monitoring these people on a weekly basis. They're in treatment multiple times per week. They're getting a shot and they're being drug tested. And the reason why they're willing to do that is because they can avoid a felony conviction if they can succeed in that treatment program. So, again, it's another tool for individuals. We're trying to prevent the future burglaries and armed robberies by catching people at the very front end of their addiction and trying to really confront it.
I'm glad you mentioned that. I didn't find the details of that piece on the official county website. That's a relatively new piece of the diversion, right?
Yeah, it is. It's a new program. The county board funded it this year, and county executive Cruiser was a huge force behind that. He's been a real spokesperson in this county for utilizing Vivitrol and other aggressive treatment methods to try to cope with this opioid crisis. And so he was extremely supportive, and we were able to get the county to put together this new program, which I think allows us, again, one more way to try to confront this this opioid process, short of incarcerating everybody who is addicted, and which, of course, is cost prohibitive.
Well, kudos to the county board and to your office for being among the leaders in the country in doing these sorts of programs. Now, you have some other diversion programs. There's underage drinking, worthless check programs as well. I may have missed one. Do you want to tell us a little bit about those, too?
Sure. Well, the other primary ones that that you didn't just mention there are, we have a veterans court where individuals who have served our country honorably and have now come back from active duty and are having problems within the criminal justice system can be placed in a veterans court where they will get services and a treatment plan that's really tailored to try to honor their service and also help them use their service as a method to try to bring some discipline back to their lives. We have a drug court and a behavioral treatment court where individuals have been identified as having either a mental illness that brings them into the criminal justice system in some chronic way or chronic drug problems. And so we have a drug court tailored to try to deal with individuals with either of those substantial set of issues. To try to divert those individuals. And then we have the underage drinking, where it's really an educational opportunity, and the worthless check one, which, of course, assists our merchants in getting the money that they deserve, but also forces people to pay restitution in an informal way.
I don't know if there's been formal outside evaluations of any of these programs here or elsewhere. Perhaps you could tell us. I know they've been anecdotally written up as being quite successful, especially the veterans program in the last year. We've heard some wonderful stories about that. What's your assessment?
Yeah, I mean, I can tell you that both veterans court and our drug court, behavioral treatment courts, work on evidence-based principles. They're evaluated every year by outside sources, and those are diversion courts that really are, have been tested. Our program in terms of opioid diversion this year, it's a first-year program, and at the end of this year, it'll be evaluated again by outside folks to be able to make sure that the county is spending their money appropriately and right, and that we're having some kind of practical impact.
Are there other counties in Wisconsin that have similar programs?
We are the only county that I'm aware of that's doing the opioid diversion program. This is a program that I have not heard of in other counties. It's a program that a lot of other counties have expressed interest in and are watching very closely.
It is going on elsewhere in the United States, though.
There are a couple of other places where it's going on, but it is a new concept. The idea of taking a person before they're charged, after they're arrested, right from custody, and putting them in treatment is something that's not being done commonly across the country yet.
That's great that we're leaders. District Attorney Gravely, your mission statement for your office is rather broad. You have a lot of things that you have to do. I wonder if we could talk a little bit about the operation of your office. You have indicated on your website that there are certain crimes that are more sensitive that you're focusing on because you can't be everywhere doing everything. You have to have an impact, and the only way to have an impact is to have some kind of focus. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that focus and also the staffing levels of the district attorney's offices in the state of Wisconsin has been an issue on and off over the past several years. I wonder how you feel we're doing in terms of adequate funding for your operations. I know part of it comes from the state, part of it comes from the county.
Right. So the lawyers in our office are state funded. So that is the state of Wisconsin that determines both our staffing level and what their salaries are. We have 16 and a half positions, legal positions, counting myself and the deputy DA. And then the support staff in our office are funded by the county. So our paralegals, our victim witness staff, our investigator, and all together, there are 39 people in our office, so 23 of those are individuals who are county funded. We are, in terms of the state numbers, and they do the statistics to sort of match, where we are. We're two prosecutors down from what would be considered appropriate to do the work we're supposed to do. And so, you know, that's the funding need we have.
Two prosecutors down.
What does
a Mike Gravely think? That's what the state thinks, and right. The statistics tell you. So what does your experience tell you?
Well, I can tell you that what happens in a district attorney's office that's two prosecutors down is that compromises have to be made. And so certain cases cannot be emphasized the way that you ideally would, and people cannot specialize in the way you ideally would. So if we were at the appropriate number as set by the state, if we had two more prosecutors, there would be somebody in our district attorney's office who would be specializing in sexual assault cases. They're the most difficult, time-consuming, arguably the most important cases in our
office.
Very
important.
And then there'd be somebody who would be specializing in gun crimes. We once had a federal gun grant where we had a chance to have one prosecutor emphasize those cases. I did that as a prosecutor for several years under a federal gun grant. And that's an issue that is rising in importance in this community right now, and certainly we would be assisted, the criminal justice system and the community would be assisted if we could have someone specialized. So we have enough people to man the courts, but we don't have enough people to provide the kind of specialty work that would be ideal.
I'm going to wave my magic wand and offer you two more prosecutors.
Yeah.
Would you turn them down?
Wouldn't turn them down, and they'd immediately begin to specialize on sexual assaults and gun crimes.
What about two more than the state has offered?
Well, two more than the state offered, we would talk even more about additional diversion opportunities, and we'd talk about community prosecuting. We'd talk about if we had two more people, we would talk about the most distressed neighborhoods in this city and whether a prosecutor who was spending a lot more time there with everybody from community groups to neighborhood watches and all that would be able to have some impact in that community.
Well, that sounds like community policing at the district attorney's office level, and I confess I have never heard that discussed before, and I'm intrigued by that. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, some of the best prosecutor's offices, the most proactive prosecutor's offices in the state and country are taking a look at specific neighborhoods and trying to have prosecutors emphasize those neighborhoods, much as community policing has officers do the same. Using their legal expertise to help solve the kind of problems that that contribute to crime. You know, is the reason why a particular block in our community is violent is because landlords are not, you know, doing the appropriate attentive job, and can a prosecutor help that? Is most of the problems that we're having in a particular neighborhood because of very specific things that could be identified by the neighbors? And are those things that the legal process could assist in? You know, and so, you know, for instance, the Milwaukee DA's office has devoted a lot of resources to community prosecutors when they've had the ability to do so.
Let's go back to the special attention crimes that you've listed on your website. Want to just go over those for us quickly as to what they are and maybe why they're important?
Sure. What we talk about is much of what we spoke about here. So there is certainly an emphasis in our office on crimes that are what we call sensitive crimes. So they are both domestic abuse issues, particularly serious bodily harm, domestic abuse cases, and sexual assaults. You know, we every year in Wisconsin, just about 50 individuals are killed in domestic violence homicides. Our community in the last month and a half has had two murder-suicides, which both were domestic violence issues. You know, we have across the country 63,000 children are going to be sexually assaulted this year. And right now, only 6 of every 1,000 abusers of children in a sexual way will go to prison. So, you know, that has to do with everybody's resources. It has to do with the difficulties of those kind of cases. And so every ounce of emphasis that a district attorney's office can place on domestic violence and sexual assault, you know, needs to be there.
I might mention that the district attorney's website has a very interesting and very helpful document from the National Center on Domestic and Sexual Violence. There's two charts, a power and control wheel, which demonstrates how the abuser exercises control, and it's a very insidious thing. It can happen to everybody and anyone. And there's the equality nonviolence wheel, which shows what a healthy relationship in a family or between two people should be like. I would criticize this because it simply talks about men committing violence against women, and we know that that is not the limit of this. So if you can keep in mind as you look at this, it applies to everybody. It has nothing to do with gender. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful resource, and I salute you for putting that up there. What other are the other areas of special emphasis for your office?
So, you know, we've talked a lot about the heroin epidemic. Currently, just in the last few years, we've gone from a community here in Kenosha County where virtually all of the drug enforcement work we were doing was cocaine, and that's now almost exclusively heroin, which is a more deadly, more addictive substance. And so a lot of emphasis in our office is on dealing with the heroin crisis by attempting to identify individuals who are dealing heroin. We've placed a great emphasis on trying to charge and prosecute individuals who provide heroin to people who overdose, because there's something called a Len Bias reckless homicide charge available there. And I think we want the consequences of providing a deadly dose of heroin to people to be something that people think about when they engage in that conduct. And then the other thing that I think we should talk about some, Lynn, is the issue of gun violence in this community, and that's certainly an emphasis for us. What I can tell you is that we went from, here in the city, we went from 29 investigated shots fired complaints where the police felt there was enough to open a case in 2012 to 67, so more than doubling that amount last year. So we clearly have an increase in people firing guns in this community, and obviously that has to do with violent crime. It has to do with potential murders. It has all sorts of ramifications in terms of people feeling safe in this community.
Is that in certain neighborhoods or more generally throughout the county?
I think the police would tell you, I think the police department has told me and would tell you that the increase is throughout the city and throughout the county. I would certainly tell you that there are more of these incidents happening in our more distressed neighborhoods, and so there's work to be done by everybody who's concerned in certain neighborhoods in this community to try to help the overwhelming majority of folks living in those neighborhoods who just want to live peaceful, safe lives.
What's the cause of all the gun violence suddenly? Why are guns being shot off more? I mean, assuming that that's just not a statistical blip and won't happen again next year or for the rest of this year, assuming that it really is a trend, what could account for that?
Well, I think there's a number of things. We're at a position where crime overall is down across the country and in our community. But there are individuals who are committing more and more chronic crime. So we have maybe a smaller subsection of individuals committing more and more serious and chronic crime. Certainly part of what I'm talking about is gang-fueled. Part of what I'm talking about is how profitable heroin is, and so how individuals who are transacting in heroin are discharging guns to protect their business interests. And then certainly part of it is domestic violence issues, which always will be responsible for a number of the shots fired and a number of the homicides. And then the last piece I'm going to say to you is that I think that when shots are fired and those cases aren't solved, that has a long-ranging consequence. Everybody feels less safe. Everybody, when they feel less safe, will cooperate with authorities less. People tend to think, well, maybe I should take this into my own hands and retaliate without using law enforcement or other resources to try to deal with the fact that my family or somebody I love or care about has been shot at. And so I think that these things tend to move in cycles. You know, you look at the vast increase in Milwaukee or Chicago and then how many of those are not solved, and how every unsolved shooting becomes something that certainly has ramifications with more violence.
Do the district attorneys' associations of our state and other states have a position on the escalating gun violence? Is there anything that they think should be done legislatively, or have they just sort of thrown up their hands?
I can't speak for all district attorneys as a group, and I can't think of anything that we've specifically done. There are a couple things we've done locally, even since I took office, that I'm hoping will have some impact. Can I talk a little bit about
those?
Yes. Okay. So, you know, when I decided I was going to run last year, I already knew that this increase had occurred and wanted to sort of figure out what to do next. And one of the things I did was I had a whole series of conversations, complicated, you know, long conversations about why violence had increased with folks like members of CUSH. You know, we talked about the award that I received, and I think it's because of the kind of efforts I made to have those conversations. And I had those conversations with law enforcement. I had those conversations with a very diverse group of individuals, including the NAACP folks that I knew and folks who were, you know, working on the ground in the neighborhoods that have the most distress in our city. And one of the things that we came to was that no one was having conversations that were organized or comprehensive about what could happen. And so a group of us came together, and eventually they became called the Kenosha Unity Coalition. And a couple of ideas they have are beginning to come to fruition. And so the first one I want to bring up is about the gun violence. What we have talked about is that some communities across the country are looking at increases in gun violence as a public health issue. And so they're thinking about it the same way you would have an outbreak of a disease that would hit in certain places. You look at who are the hosts, you know, where did it begin, and sort of, and you talk about statistically and using evidence-based, you know, sort of work, you know, what can you do to interrupt that disease? People were using this sort of thing to look at violence in communities, and so we're doing that now. And I'll give you a couple examples, if you'll permit me to do that for a second. One of the things we've done is we've started a multi-agency group that'll meet twice a week if there's been particular shootings that have happened in the community. This happens at the DA's office. Participating in that are gang diversion folks who are employed by a variety of agencies, probation and parole, the city police department, gang unit officers, my office, members of the school, Boys and Girls Club representatives. And what we're doing is we're meeting and talking about each and every shooting that happens in the community. And the focus of those meetings are, does anybody at the table from all those agencies know some additional facts the police don't know about who was targeted, about the location it happened, and about who are now the suspects in the case? So is there any way we can assist the police in solving this crime so it's not an unsolved case that might have further ramifications? The second piece of those meetings twice a week are who at the table can think of a way we can stop the retaliatory shooting that might happen next. So what is our preventative moment that we can have in these meetings? So then we take the statistics. What we're doing is we're looking at everything from the time of day to location to whether cars were used to get in and out of the situation to whether people are cooperative to who's been targeted to who are suspected. We're looking at all the sort of things that a medical model would look at. And we're collating that data. And we have a social scientist professor who did this same thing for the Milwaukee Homicide Review folks in Milwaukee. And she's going to crunch that data, and we're going to have a data committee that meets every month to talk about what the patterns are of the violence we have. Is it all in certain neighborhoods? Is it all certain individuals, et cetera? And we're going to look at that to see what the medium and long-term solutions are to this issue. We've never done that in Kenosha. We've never comprehensively looked at why guns are being fired in this town. And I'm hoping that we'll be guided to some solutions. I'm hoping that we'll be able to take that to public officials and say, here's a few things we didn't know before, and maybe here are a few things we might suggest to be able to tamp down the violence that is obviously increasing in terms of guns in our community.
Well, that's a very constructive approach based on evidence and collecting the evidence we need to make some sound decisions and policy recommendations for the future. That's terrific. It sounds like we're ahead of the game again. I might note that your website for the County District Attorney's Office has a good list of community resources that is really a very sound list that people ought to be aware of, too. Now, I'd like to turn to another issue that's related to your office. It's about something called Marcy's Law, and that's spelled M-A-R-S-Y apostrophe S for our listeners who want to look it up. It's a national movement proceeding state by state. It's about victims' rights, and they're looking for not laws to be passed, but constitutional amendments to be passed in every state and to the federal constitution as well. They're particularly targeting 15 state constitutions that do not extend what they call enumerated rights to victims of crime. District Attorney Gravely, what is Marcy's Law all about, and what's the status of this in Wisconsin? We have already some laws that protect victims in Wisconsin that were recently enacted.
Right. So I can really only speak to this to Wisconsin. So I really don't have any information or help for you on sort of where it is nationally. I can tell you that Marcy's Law is about enshrining in the state constitution some protections for victims on a practical level in the criminal justice system. And we do have a set of laws already in Wisconsin. The website for Marcy's Law talks about how Wisconsin is ahead of the game in this respect. Some states are lag far behind, but we have laws that allow victims to be in courtrooms and have their say at sentencings about what should happen in a particular case, that they have a legal right to notice in Wisconsin of all hearings, and a legal right to consult the DA's office before the case is disposed of. So a legal right to have interaction with the DA's office about their opinions about the case. So those are things that are already enshrined in our state statutes, and this is an effort to expand those to our Constitution.
And I might note that the District Attorney's Association of the state is very strongly behind it. Now, I think the first question a reasonable person might ask is, well, we have laws. Why do we need to go through all this constitutional amendment stuff?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's a confusing question for people, so I'm glad – thank you for asking it that way. So, you know, what happens is the rights of a criminal defendant are enshrined in the Constitution. A whole set of criminal cases from our Supreme Court have said these are your constitutional rights if you're charged with a crime. The victim rights we're talking about are only in a state law. And so if there's ever a time where there's a conflict between what a defendant perceives as his constitutional right to a fair trial and to provide the defense that he wishes versus a victim, the defendant's rights will always win because the Constitution trumps a mere statute. So if you have a constitutional amendment, you put the victim's rights on an equal footing. And at that point, the case is decided on its merits by a judge. It's not decided by who the automatic winner is based on who has the Constitution and who has a statute.
So what's left in the state of Wisconsin that the Marcy's Law would ensure? Is there anything significant that's left besides that constitutional protection?
Yeah. Well, I mean, one significant and practical way that I think of Marcy's Law as having an impact would be privacy rights for victims. You know, right now, a victim who is an adult must be listed by name, typically in a criminal complaint, and that criminal complaint is a public document. It's an easily accessible document to the public. So, for instance, I've had criminal cases before. I had a recent case where members of a gang in town here got a hold of the complaint, which is easily accessible.
It's a public record.
It's a public record, and it can be found on websites commonly, et cetera. And that document had the names of the individuals who were victims and who had provided information to police. That was then spread by the gang members on social media, which was a significantly intimidating factor for the victims, really scared them to death. And that's the sort of thing where if there was a constitutional amendment, the way I would have drafted that criminal complaint would have been to use mere initials. Then the identities of those victims would be much less accessible. You'd have to go through many more public stages to get that information. And that victim's easily detectable identity would not be available. Same thing would be true if someone's a victim of domestic violence and is worried about a word of their being a victim getting back to their workplace. They're worried it'll impact their career or their friends' And so, you know, right now that the name of that person is commonly in a complaint. If this was passed and they and a victim had a right to privacy, I would likely be much more aggressive in the district attorney's office in only providing initials in criminal complaints to protect people from, you know, their neighbors or their bosses or anybody else knowing that they had been a victim of a crime unless they wanted to share that themselves.
Would there still be other ways for this information to get into the public, however?
Well, sure. You know, eventually police reports are available. You have to, you know, fill out an open records request. You know, that's documented. We know who the individual is who's requesting those records. So, you know, there are ways that the public would still be able to find that. And frankly, there should be. You know, that this is, should not be an absolute right of privacy. But, you know, it is the kind of protection that I think prevents some people from cooperating with law enforcement because they don't want to be disclosed, and also and prevents sometimes people from even reporting crime.
So in your view, this is a really significant benefit to not only the victims but to the criminal justice system in terms of fairness and achieving justice then?
Yeah, I think it has a very positive practical application in the ways I talked about.
Now, wouldn't it cost money to implement this in your office? Is there any money attached to it?
I really don't think it does, because it enshrines the same basic things that are talked about before. You know, in the example I gave you, drafting a criminal complaint with initials instead of the name is zero additional cost. We already have a staff of people who are in contact with each and every victim who wishes to be in contact with us. So our district attorney's office, because of the current statutes, employs four people full-time, where their primary job is interacting with victims of crime.
So as far as you would estimate, this is this constitutional amendment in the state of Wisconsin would be revenue neutral in terms of an expense neutral.
In Wisconsin it would be.
Because of the laws we already have.
In a state where this statute, where those laws did not exist, it would be a significant increase, because obviously a lot of resources are used in Wisconsin to make sure victims have their say and are consulted. That is a costly thing, but I think it's a worthwhile thing, because victims certainly, you know, are persons who deserve that kind of time and attention.
Mike, I was born and raised in Kenosha, and Kenosha has really changed since the 1940s. It's a new world here, and we are squeezed between these two major metropolitan centers, and we are part of the big megalopolis. We're used to blaming a lot of our problems in crime on Milwaukee and Chicago. Does that make sense to you?
Well, I mean, I have heard that many times in my career here as well. You know, so when I got here in 89, a continuous tenor of folks who, particularly people who'd been in Kenosha a long time, is that almost all of this crime is from outsiders. And I'm going to suggest two things. One, when we do the science that I talked about before, that's one of the things we're really going to be able to answer. You know, we probably should not run our criminal justice system by anecdote. We should probably look at evidence whenever we can. And so I really think that's a process here. But the other thing is that, you know, we just need to understand that a lot of the crime that we now have in Kenosha is homegrown. And so, you know, once a person accepts that, then they really can sort of get their hands dirty to try to solve these problems. And so, you know, I obviously my anecdotes are more extensive than maybe some of the folks who say, hey, it's all people from outside. And I can tell you that a very large amount of the crime that we're dealing with in the criminal justice system are folks who were born and raised here. And so it's time to, you know, really attack those problems that we see, everything from opioid addiction to, you know, how parents are raising their kids in certain situations. All those kind of things, you know, are things that we really need to be real about, not just dismiss or oversimplify these problems by saying this is just outsiders.
District Attorney Gravely, if you could leave our listeners with one piece of advice in the next moment, what would you tell them to keep themselves safe?
Well, you know, my advice to keep people safe would be just, you know, be always aware and don't be naive. You know, understand that those things our parents told us as kids should still be our golden rules. You know, treat people respectfully. You know, don't do anything in traffic or over the phone or to other people that you know, don't treat people in a way that, you know, that isn't as respectful as you would want. And the other advice I want to give people in general is, you know, this conversation we've had today has been a complicated conversation about the criminal justice system. I really just want to beg people, please always remember that when people start suggesting simple solutions to the problems we've talked about today, that almost certainly you should dismiss those out of hand. These are complicated problems. They take long.